This is not your grandma's Bible study.
Hey, y'all. Welcome to Not Your Grandma's Bible Study. This is Jill. I'm alone this week. Zach is on vacation. So I decided I didn't want you to miss out on any content. We didn't want to lose any momentum with the podcast itself. So I'm going to read to you a paper that I wrote about the infancy gospel of Thomas. This gospel is really easy to find if you just Google it. You can read the actual text itself. Because of time, I'm not going to summarize the whole story. It's an account of Jesus's childhood, in which Jesus is quite the turd. He kills his playmates because they mess up his pool of water. He kills a teacher. He's just a nightmare. It reminds me a little bit of the Twilight Zone episode with the little boy who, if he knows that you said something bad about him, will hurt you with his mind. I feel like this story must have been an influence for the writing of that episode. So you should go watch that episode of The Twilight Zone too. Don't know what it's called. I just know it's a little boy who can control things with his mind and is really mean if you don't like him. Anyway, here we go. So the Infancy Gospel of Thomas. So this book is a perplexing account of the childhood of Jesus. Jesus is not presented as the ideal child, but as a powerful bully, indiscriminately doling out punishment on any who dare to cross him. On the surface, this story does not appear to view Jesus favorably. He kills his playmates, he disobeys his parents, he strikes down his teachers, and he sets his entire community on edge. However, building on the work of Christy Absenseia, if I'm mispronouncing that name, Christy, I'm very sorry. I will argue that the redactor uses several techniques to redirect the audience's attention away from Jesus's arbitrary violence, stories that were composed by adversaries, according to Absenseia, by presenting stories in which violence is acceptable and expected. So thus, the classroom scenes, specifically, that I'm going to look at, were intentionally set beside unflattering portrayals of a violent and impetuous young Jesus, and Joseph is presented as a less than capable parent. The redactor of the gospel, through clever sleight, positions Jesus as the superior teacher in the story and thereby creates an acceptable use for his violence. An acceptable space for use of his violence, and we'll get into that. The infancy gospel appears to have been popular in various locations throughout the first millennium of church history. There are 14 Greek manuscripts, several in Syriac, and at least one fragment in Latin. The gospel is attested to in 13 antique and medieval languages total. The difficulty with this abundance of resources is that they differ so widely from one another. Even the Greek manuscripts differ radically from one another, with entire chapters missing from some witnesses and present in others. Further, the earliest witnesses are from the 5th or the 6th century, though scholars tend to date the original Greek text to the 2nd century. In 1853, Constantine von Tischendorf compiled two 15th century manuscripts to form a 19-chapter version called Greek A, which is the best-known version of the Gospel today. However, because there were, quote, other forms of the text used by other translators into other languages centuries earlier, it is well nigh impossible to know in some cases which of the disputed stories of Tischendorf's fuller Greek A derive from the oldest traceable form of the tradition in which are later medieval editions, end quote. For the purposes of this paper, fully aware that there are textual problems, I'm going to use the gospel text found in Codex Sabaiaticus 259, which was the primary manuscript used in Tischendorf's Greek A version. I choose this manuscript because it is the oldest extant Greek manuscript and because of its length. So I'm going to assume a 2nd century Greco-Roman context for my reading. That's just all the technical stuff. Just want anybody listening to know I'm going in eyes wide open that this interpretation is based off of a constructed text to an extent. So the history of scholarship of the infancy Gospel of Thomas here. The Gospel gives scholars a unique glimpse into early Christian understandings of Jesus, as well as early Christian self-definition. One of the most controversial features of the gospel is the arbitrarily violent way in which Jesus is presented. How do we make sense of stories that have been passed through the centuries by Christians, apparently with some popularity, that run counter to conventional, even orthodox, understandings of Jesus? Since we know that the individual episodes of the text circulated independently before a redactor assembled them into the text that we now call the Infancy Gospel of Thomas, scholars are left wondering why the second century compiler would have included these stories in his collection and why later Christians would have continued to copy and to read them. So scholars have posited several explanations, including comparisons to other God-child and hero-child stories, comparisons with short-tempered Jewish heroes, and comparisons to stories of the adult Jesus found in the canonical Gospels. More recently, writer Asgard has posited that the Gospel has, in its redacted form, it serves as Christianity's first children's story. He argues that the Gospel can offer a glimpse into ancient child pedagogy, and in particular, into how early Christians communicated religious beliefs to their children. The Gospel may be offering a case of applied pedagogy. The story can be seen as the kind of material employed to introduce Christian children or Christian beliefs to children. So while it can be imagined that certain episodes of the Gospel, such as when Jesus kills his playmates for messing up his pool of water and physically running into him in the village, these stories might be told to a misbehaving child by a frustrated parent or caregiver. The redaction of the classroom scenes alongside these others changes that dynamic. If the purpose of the redacted document is to function as an important means of exerting social control, as Asgard argues, then showing Jesus violently rejecting pedagogical authority in the classroom seems counterproductive. And it should be noted, just for those of you who don't know, when I use the term redaction, I just mean the person who compiled these stories into a coherent whole, not necessarily the author of all of them, although there may be stuff that the redactor created to link these stories together. But it's more than authorship per se. So the view that I'm going to really support here is proposed by Kristen Apsensaya, and she argues that opponents of Christianity composed the unflattering portrayals of Jesus' childhood. She begins by rebutting arguments that ancient readers would have been more comfortable with the cursing and killing Jesus than modern readers by reviewing literature contemporary with the gospel that discusses ancient elite views of anger. So she notes, quote, from the treatises that survived, as well as references to lost treatises, it is clear that there was near universal agreement that anger was ignoble and even dangerous emotion that ought to be suppressed, if not eradicated altogether, end quote. Toward her argument that opponents crafted some of the episodes found in the gospel, she notes that displays of anger were indicative of a person's, quote, character and status, on noblemen's ability to sensibly wield power, and on the proper balance of social hierarchies and communal order. So in short, ancient audiences were not comfortable with this version of Jesus any more than modern audiences are. So though Apsensaya never explicitly states it, it seems that simply telling stories of Jesus as a child, especially as one so violent and uncontrolled, is an assault on the character of Jesus himself. She notes, some degree of youthful impetuosity was allowed since it was presumed that children would grow out of it or grow tired of it and eventually despise rash thinking and behavior when allowed to moderately indulge in it, but also that the worst fate of all would be never to outgrow temperament and behavior that was excusable only in one's youth. Such behavior was regarded as disgraceful, warranting a shameful moniker, nepie, or childish, end quote. For opponents to depict Jesus as a child at all, especially as one so impetuous, is to depict him as childish. This double denigration constructs a Jesus who, quote, whether man or God, is an ignoble figure. He is enslaved to his own anger. He becomes irate at seemingly trivial offenses. The lowest of the low, other children, have power over him as they prove they can upset him with the slightest provocation, end quote. Okay, so after arguing that the violent scenes in the gospel would have been equally unsettling for ancient readers, she moves to situate the gospel in rhetorical and apologetic conventions of ancient Christians. She argues that ancient orators and writers often used the tropes of childhood intelligence and schooling, as well as the use of privilege and power. She says, the young men who used their strengths for the benefit of others were esteemed, while those who looked only to their own advantage or who misused their power were loathed. Beyond these typical tropes, Christian apologists had also had their own apologetic techniques. They could write treatises to respond to attacks or absorb their opponents' attacks into their own narratives to give Jesus an opportunity to answer the charges, or with evidence to the contrary, to prove them groundless. So with this groundwork laid, Absinthia proposes that the redactor offered readers new intertexts to shift the meaning they gleaned from the stories, that he sequenced the stories to present a narrative of maturation, and that he forefronted other characters who could absorb some of the blame for Jesus' behavior. So while I agree with her conclusions, she really doesn't explore how the redactor's intertexts function to create these new spaces for meaning. So I will consider how the classroom scenes and how the Joseph scenes make new meanings of the opponent-composed episodes possible. So I'm going to do this by reading the scenes closely to illuminate the student-teacher and the son-father dynamics that serve to counter the Jesus Playmates local community dynamic. And throughout, I'm going to consider some of the techniques used by the redactor that make the maturation work. And finally, I'm going to explore how the oral performance of this gospel might have impacted the overall impression of the narrative on its hearers. So, summary. Opponents wrote these really nasty stories of Jesus as a child killing his playmates and being arbitrarily douchey. Redactor sees this, and his response to it, or the community the redactor comes from, is to absorb these stories as opposed to dismissing them, rewriting them, or putting them alongside the narrative pieces I'm going to look at, which is Jesus in a classroom and Jesus with his father, to demonstrate that throughout his childhood, Jesus matures, but also that Jesus is not totally to blame, that his teachers and his father both have, bear some responsibility for Jesus's bad behavior. Okay, hope that makes sense. So let's talk about Jesus and his teachers. So the tale of Jesus and the teacher forms the nucleus of the structure of the second century infancy gospel. It forms a threefold narrative that points towards the central theme in the message, namely that the child Jesus and not the adult teachers is the one who's teaching. That's a quote by Andreas van Aard. Just kidding. Van Aard, no G in there. These three scenes are foundational in understanding how the redactor of the gospel wants Jesus to be perceived, and, if Absinthia is correct, for making sense of the arbitrarily violent scenes earlier in the gospel. Violence in pedagogy was ubiquitous in the ancient world. The classroom scenes, with their acceptable violence, create a space in which a violent Jesus is not unimaginable and is perhaps expected. So the acceptable, or at least common, violence of the classroom scenes mitigates the effects of the arbitrary violence on the reader. For this discussion, I'm going to pay careful attention to the ways that the stories portray the dynamic between Jesus and his readers, or sorry, Jesus and his teachers, and how those interactions might be surprising to or anticipated by a second century reader. So chapters 6 through 8 of the Infancy Gospel. The first classroom scene builds on the unruly behavior of Jesus in the previous episodes. In chapter 3, Jesus kills the son of the high priest for questioning Jesus' activity on the Sabbath and for destroying the pools of water that Jesus had created. In chapter 4, Jesus kills another child for bumping into him on the road. In chapter 5, Joseph attempts to correct Jesus, but Jesus only lashes out against his accusers by blinding them. Nobody had to die. So after several episodes demonstrating Jesus' violent and rash behavior, a teacher, Zacchaeus, approaches Joseph and asks him to give over the boy, quote, so that he can be taught letters and so that he can have all understanding, learn to have affection for those his own age, and respect the old and please elders. That's in 6:2. Joseph responds with doubt that his son can be controlled or taught. Jesus, upon overhearing this discussion, responds to both by asserting his authority and his preexistence. He tells them that he is, quote, from outside of you, because of his, quote, noble birth in the flesh. He further tells Joseph, quote, when you were born, I existed and came to you. Asgard suggests that this is probably an attempt at expressing the incarnation, his divinity or his preexistence and his otherness, and his being, his real presence in the world. Instead of Zacchaeus and Joseph, the crowds react to Jesus' proclamation with surprise that a five-year-old speaks in a way that no other teacher or Pharisee has spoken. Jesus' response to the crowds, however, indicates that the crowd's reaction to Jesus was sarcastic. He says, quote, "Why do you marvel, and why do you even not believe that I told you what is true?" Upon silencing the crowds, Jesus, quote, "went up to them, leapt about, and said, I was playing with you, for I know that you are easily impressed and small-minded." So, precocious. This final statement of Jesus seems out of place. Was Jesus joking about his identity before? Asgard does not seem to think that this is the case. Instead, he argues, quote, "the statement makes much more sense if it is taken to imply that Jesus is trying the others out, but is shown to be in control. He is able to twist them around his finger." Interpreted this way, the words are a criticism of their failure to understand who Jesus is, end quote. So if it is the case that Jesus is criticizing the crowd's lack of understanding, and I think that the following scene will illustrate that it is, then this marks a transition, a maturation, if you will, in the presentation of Jesus from rash to intentional. After this initial dialogue, Zacchaeus attempts to teach Jesus his letters. Jesus is unresponsive in his lessons, so Zacchaeus hits him in the head. A teacher striking a student would not likely have surprised an ancient reader. The Roman classroom was not designed for the comfort of the student. Conspicuous in the classroom was the master in his high-backed chair, his pupils pushed to gain their rightful places on their backless benches. Most remarkable was the complete absence of desks. That is a description of the classroom by Stanley Bonner. So beyond this discomfort of the space for the students, Bonner says that corporal punishment was a constant feature of school life. Teachers had many tools at their disposal to dispense their punishment on pupils. The most common was a ferule, or maybe ferule. I don't know Latin pronunciation, so forgive me. All you Latin speakers out there. It was a cane cut from the stalk of a giant fennel. It was light and easy to manipulate, but it might have had a few nasty knots. Less common but more severe were the scutica and the virgae, so the whip and rods. For these punishments, I'm just going to quote Bonner here again, the boy was made to strip down to his loincloth and was hoisted up by two of his schoolfellows, one of whom, turning his back, took the culprit's arms over his shoulders and grasped his wrists firmly, whilst the other lifted him up by the ankles. Back and buttocks were thus conveniently exposed. End quote. So while corporal punishment had its prominent protesters, there was never really any condemnation by the public at large. The utility of violence, according to Martin Bloomer, in promoting students' participation seems well established by the longevity of such forms of school exercise. So corporal punishment was ubiquitous, and ancient readers would have been familiar with this reality. Returning to the infancy gospel, ancient audiences would not have been surprised that a teacher used violence to provoke disinterested students into participation. So they would not have been surprised either to see that sort of it worked. Jesus does respond to the teacher, but in anger, saying, I want to teach you rather than be taught by you. Jesus then calms down, recites the Greek alphabet, and then challenges teacher on the nature of the alpha. When Zacchaeus cannot answer him, Jesus explains it to him. Jesus's answer is seemingly nonsense. However, recalling Jesus's interaction with the crowds just immediately preceding the scene, Asgard sees this as, quote, a parody of reading exercises familiar to anyone having attended the antique school, and argues, quote, Jesus' explanation of the alpha leaves the teacher and others overwhelmed as for his wisdom. They are unable to understand and explore the depths of his words. For the real-life audience of the gospel, however, the passage will function differently. It would be obvious that this was a parody. They would sense what Jesus was at, and they could amuse themselves with the shortcomings of such an authority figure. And that's basically just me quoting Asgard for the last 45 minutes. After Jesus explains the alpha to Zacchaeus, Zacchaeus laments his shame and his inferiority to the child, saying, I thought to have a student, but ended up having a master. This ironic twist continues the work of transitioning the reader away from the rash Jesus to the teacher Jesus. It is important to note that in spite of his anger, Jesus does not harm the teacher in this scene. Certainly he outsmarts him, and he proves himself to be the teacher, but he does so without recourse to violence. Zacchaeus' recognition of Jesus as teacher marks a transition in the use of violence throughout the rest of the story. It is because of Zacchaeus' recognition that Jesus heals all whom he has cursed previously in the story. So this non-violent teaching scene and the healing of those previously cursed is critical to justify the violence that Jesus will do to his next teacher. So Zacchaeus calls him teacher, which ups his status. In response, Jesus heals everybody he's hurt prior. And then in the next section that we're going to look at, Jesus uses violence against his teacher. But this violence done to the next teacher reframes the violence in the first five chapters by presenting a plausible context in which Jesus can and perhaps should be violent. That is, he is a teacher, and teachers use violence to teach. There are many possible ways that the opponent composed stories of the unruly child Jesus could have been dealt with. Upsensaya notes that there were apologetic treatises defending Christianity from attack. It's also possible that some attacks on Christians were ignored. But this redactor chose to pair unflattering stories with other stories that alter the reader's opinions and options for meaning-making. So the choice to pair them with classroom scenes is, in my opinion, a clever way that the redactor is able to redirect the reader's attention from the rash violence of the earlier episodes to the acceptable violence of the classroom. So this first classroom scene is necessarily nonviolent. In terms of ancient pedagogy, a teacher could punish the student, but not the other way around. Jesus must be established as the teacher in order for his violence in the following scene to be viewed as appropriate. Zacchaeus' lament in chapter 7 provides that affirmation. The episodes between this classroom scene and the next in chapter 13 that we're going to look at include several miraculous moments in which Jesus helps his community and his family, raising a dead boy, carrying water to the home, and working alongside his father in the fields and as a carpenter. So these scenes continue the theme of the nonviolent yet still powerful Jesus. In chapter 13, we have the second classroom scene, and this one begins with Joseph's initiative. Jesus has just helped Joseph with a carpentry job in chapter 12. In that scene, Joseph is asked to make a bed, but did not have two boards of equal length suitable for the task. Jesus miraculously stretches out a shorter board to match the length of the longer board. Joseph embraces and kisses his son and exclaims, "Blessed am I, since God gave me this child." This encounter with his son changes Joseph's perspective on the need for Jesus' education. In chapter 6, Joseph is reluctant to allow Jesus to go to school, whereas now Joseph is eager because he saw his wise and sensible thinking, and he didn't want him to be unacquainted with the letters, 13:1. On the surface, it appears that Jesus has changed from the rash child killing his playmates to a more sensible child helping his parents within the home. However, the listener of the story would recall that not long ago, Jesus had bested his first teacher precisely because he did know his letters. Joseph still misunderstands that Jesus is the teacher. Thus, his decision to send Jesus back to school heightens the suspense for the reader of how Jesus will react. This classroom scene begins with a teacher writing the alphabet and telling Jesus to say Alpha. This time, Jesus responds without provocation by violence. He tells the teacher, "You tell me first what the beta is, and I shall tell you what the alpha is." The teacher, angered by Jesus' response, strikes him. This time, instead of calming himself and then demonstrating his superior abilities, Jesus curses and kills his teacher. So though death is admittedly an extreme response, there are several reasons why an ancient audience might not be completely unnerved by this reaction. First, Jesus was shown to be and acknowledged to be teacher in the previous classroom scene. While Joseph has forgotten this, the reader would not have forgotten the ironic twist of the last classroom scene. Second, as discussed before, violence was commonplace in ancient pedagogy. That Jesus, as the teacher, would use violence would not have been shocking. The extremity of the violence could be meant to illustrate that Jesus is more powerful than any teacher, having punishments worse than the Pharolei, Sudica, and Vergae. However, just because Jesus can be violent in acceptable scenarios does not mean that he should be. There well could have been readers who found even this Jesus violent in an appropriate context, unattractive, and rash. Which brings me to a third possible reaction from ancient audiences. So recall at the end of the Zacchaeus scene, Jesus restores all whom he has cursed. Knowing that Jesus can undo the things that he has done might have given a reader hope that this teacher's death is not the end of the story. As the immediately following third classroom scene will show, the teacher's fate is not yet sealed. So chapter 14, the final classroom scene begins like the first. Much like Zacchaeus from chapter 6 through 8, the teacher initiates the instruction. The teacher says he will use flattery in order to teach Jesus. This is the same tack taken by Zacchaeus and in 6:8, where it says, "And the master flattered him and brought him into the classroom." So while in the Zacchaeus scene, Joseph does not speak to the teacher, in this scene, Joseph says to the teacher, if you are that courageous, brother, take him along with you. The word for courageous is tharaleos. In the New Testament, this word and its variations most often connote confidence more than courage because there's no immediate threat. But in this case, it may also connote courage because, as Joseph well knows, Jesus is capable of killing his teacher if crossed. Joseph hands his son over to the teacher, who led him away with much fear and worry. 14:1. It's interesting that the teacher volunteers to take Jesus as his pupil and yet is fearful as he takes him into the classroom. What provoked the teacher to take on a student whom he feared is not indicated in the text, but perhaps the teacher felt it his duty to help control the boy. So though Jesus has a reason to find working with another instructor pointless, he outsmarted his first teacher in 6 through 8 and struck down his second in 13. He gladly goes to this third teacher. His motivation is not explicit. Is he looking forward to outsmarting another teacher? Is he hopeful that this teacher can teach him? Did the flattery the teacher said he would use to teach the boy work to get him to agree to more instruction? The text doesn't say, but in any event, Jesus is content to attend these lessons. This third teacher, however, never actually gets the chance to teach Jesus. Jesus begins his lesson by immediately picking up a book from the reading desk, the Analogeo, noting that it was not God's law, and opening his mouth, quote, "uttered words so awe-inspiring that the teacher sitting opposite was glad to hear all he said and encouraged him to say more." That's in 14:2. Recalling that students did not have desks in the ancient classroom, the reading desk would have been the teacher's. So Jesus' first move upon entering the room was then to go to the teacher's desk. This is another indicator to the reader that it is Jesus who is the teacher in this scene. Spatially, he has chosen the point of authority for himself. This presumptuous move proves to be another ironic twist, resituating authority into the body of a young child. The teacher is awestruck, as are the crowds. So Joseph runs quickly to the classroom, suspecting that this teacher was now in trouble and suffered. The text does not indicate what triggers Joseph's suspicion. Perhaps he heard Jesus teaching, or perhaps knowing the rashness of his son's previous behavior, he could anticipate a deadly scenario. Upon Joseph's arrival, the teacher reassures him that his son is full of grace and wisdom. While the first teacher, Zacchaeus, found the child to be otherworldly and intelligent, he was debilitated by this encounter with Jesus. This third teacher also recognizes Jesus' wisdom, but he does not appear to be threatened by it, at least not in the same way that Zacchaeus was. So there was a progression with the interactions between Jesus and his teachers. Jesus teaches his teachers, uses violence in order to teach a lesson on the second teacher. And this lesson seems to work so well that the third teacher recognizes Jesus' wisdom without even having the opportunity to instruct him. The teacher's responses to Jesus are varied, terrified and unsettled by his wisdom, aggravated and violent toward him to modify his behavior, which backfires, and finally accepting of his wisdom and his grace. This praise of Jesus, like the conclusion of the Zacchaeus scene, results in the healing of the teacher whom Jesus struck down. This does not, as Christopher Frelingos argues, of course, obliterate the record of malevolent deeds performed by the child Jesus, but the reversal suggests a purpose to the violence without prior injury. There could not be a splendid act of restoration. The dubious meaning of a sign of ill intent is transformed through the multivalent potential of spectacle. So these reversals are another technique that the redactor uses to recontextualize Jesus's violence. While the ironic classroom scenes create an appropriate space in which Jesus's violence is acceptable or at least commonplace, the reversals undo the damage from Jesus's earlier, more rash displays of violence. Okay, so that's the teaching scenes. Now let's talk a little bit about transference of blame that's happening. Christy Epsonsaya notes that in some of the stories, quote, the redactor intentionally linked the crowd's reactions to Jesus' behavior in an effort to shift the blame for Jesus' behavior away from Jesus and onto his community, onto those who misunderstood his power and purpose, and thus require discipline. So she notes especially the way the redactor treats Joseph and how the episodes in which he features demonstrate him to be incapable of managing his own son. So she writes, quote, according to pedagogical experts of the time, it would be quite appropriate to blame Joseph for Jesus' actions. Cicero, Quintilian, and Pseudo-Plutarch stress the importance of parental involvement in their children's education. Parents, along with nurses and pedagogues, were the earliest sources of their children's opinions, acting as instructors, nurturers, and models of virtue, end quote. Specifically, Epsonsaya notes the ways that the community reacts to Jesus' behavior by going to Joseph to handle the discipline. In chapter 2, when Jesus crafts the clay sparrows on the Sabbath, another Jew approaches Joseph saying, he has made clay on the Sabbath, which isn't allowed, and formed 12 sparrows. When Joseph confronts Jesus, Jesus brings the birds to life. Joseph's attempt to correction does not alter Jesus' behavior. Instead, upon being confronted by his playmate, Jesus kills him in chapter 3. In chapter 4, after Jesus kills the boy for running into him, the boy's parents blamed Joseph, saying, because you have this child, you can't live with us in this village. If you want to be here, teach him to bless and not to curse. In chapter 5, Joseph, under the pressure of the parents of the boy whom Jesus killed for running into him, attempts to admonish his son. Joseph tells his son that their neighbors hate them. Jesus responds with further violence, blinding those accusers. Joseph then grabs and yanks Jesus' ear to punish him, but Jesus responds by saying, let it suffice for you to seek and find me, and not also to torment me by having a natural ignorance. You do not see the light, why I am yours. Behold, you know that you cannot distress me, for I am yours and have been put in your hands. Jesus' response to his father is admittedly enigmatic, and there are some textual issues to boot. So on the one hand, he essentially calls his father ignorant, but on the other, he affirms that he belongs to Joseph. The other characters that strike Jesus are struck back. Here, he does not strike his father down, but he does talk back by calling him ignorant and qualifying Joseph's claim of authority over him. So it seems that the ambiguity of Jesus' response works in two ways. First, Joseph is still not the authoritarian father capable of controlling his son. And secondly, Jesus is presented as having knowledge his father does not have. But part of that knowledge is that he has been put in Joseph's hands. This tension with his father continues throughout the narrative. So as discussed above, Jesus tells Joseph that he existed when Joseph was born. Yet Joseph puts him in school without any resistance from Jesus. Later, Jesus is found helping his father in the fields and in the workshop. Yet Jesus proves to be more capable than his father in these endeavors. Jesus' one measure of grain sown reaped 100 measures. Jesus' involvement in carpentry allowed Joseph to complete a job he did not have the necessary equipment to complete. These scenes, like the classroom scenes, demonstrate that Jesus is not in need of a teacher. He can work in the field and the workshop more capably than his father, even if he does the work for his father's benefit. The final scene of the infancy gospel, chapter 17, is familiar from Luke 2. Jesus travels with his parents to Jerusalem for Passover. His parents return all the way home before they realize Jesus is not with them. When they find him 3 days later, he is sitting with the elders, explaining to them the main points of the law and the riddles and the parables of the prophets, and that's in 17:2. Continuing the theme, Jesus is a superior teacher, even to those in the Jerusalem temple. Joseph is conspicuous by his absence. Though the generic parents is used to refer both to Mary and Joseph, Mary, who has heretofore played a very minimal role, is the one explicitly named and the one who addresses the child. Mary asks her son why he has caused them distress and anxiety. Jesus replies, "Why were you searching for me? Did you not know that I must be in my father's house?" In the context of the infancy gospel, this question reiterates Jesus' position as teacher. Where else would someone with Jesus' wisdom be but teaching in the temple? Moreover, the question displaces Joseph. The redactor's use of this story highlights the way that Joseph has been a subpar father throughout the narrative by refusing his named presence and replacing Jesus' earthly father with God. Even the scribes and Pharisees ignore his presence, speaking solely to Mary, a dialogue absent in the Lucan version. The scribes and the Pharisees bless Mary and praise Jesus' wisdom and virtue. Upon their departure, the text says that Jesus followed his mother and was obedient to his parents. Again, this story highlights the tension in the familial relationship. On the one hand, Jesus has separated himself from his parents and, when questioned, does not apologize, but questions why they were looking for him to begin with. On the other hand, Jesus goes home with his family and is obedient to them. This scene, like the scenes with Joseph in the field and the workshop, simultaneously foreground Jesus' authority as a teacher and his parents' lack of control over their son. So while Mary is not shown favorably in this scene, Joseph is not seen favorably throughout the gospel. Upson Sayre writes, the infancy gospel's depiction of Joseph's responsibility for Jesus' unruly behavior, therefore, seems a contextually plausible way for the editor to explain Jesus' bad behavior without having to blame the boy himself. So in addition to the redactor's use of the classroom scenes to redirect attention from Jesus' rash violence to a space where Jesus' violence is acceptable and expected, as well as the transference of blame to Jesus' father for his inability to control an unruly son, the redactor also ordered his narrative in a way that moves the audience further from the initial scenes of Jesus' impetuous youth to the presumably familiar temple scene that could transition them back into stories of an adult Jesus with which they are comfortable. Further, it should be noted that the primary mode for ancient audiences to encounter these stories was orally. Christian writers, even as they worked to create a book culture, were writing documents that would be performed for people to hear and to see. In the primarily oral society of the ancient Roman Empire, written texts were viewed as a sort of vehicle for oral words. Further, the orator of the text would often study and memorize the text before the presentation or performance. Peter Botha writes, through the skillful use of voice and gesture, the presentation of felt emotional values, and the thorough knowledge of the style and images of a given manuscript, the oral reciter in Greco-Roman culture was able to give powerful renditions of texts. The orator's goal was to connect the authors and the audience in a real way. Considering that the stories of Jesus' violence against his playmates occurs in the first 5 chapters, and that those chapters cover only about 25% of this gospel, the orator had ample opportunity to redirect his or her audience's attention away from those stories by constructing the space for hearers to reimagine the youth of Jesus in terms of growth and maturity, rather than rashness, arbitrary violence, and, in general, douchiness. So I think with Kristen Upson-Sayre that the redactor of this gospel put this gospel together as a response to outsider attacks. Through incorporating the defamatory narratives, the new intertexts create space for new meanings and interpretations to emerge. You should go read the infancy gospel of Thomas. It is crazy. And that's sort of my analysis of how the redactor used stories that were created as a rhetorical attack and did a little bit of ancient spin and made them where they showed Jesus was growing and maturing and becoming the person that we see when we get to the gospels that are in the canon. This has been fun. I'm Jill, Zach again on vacation. Hope you had a good time, buddy. And, find us. We are on iTunes. We're on Google Podcasts. We're on iHeartRadio now. We are on Spotify. Always find us on SoundCloud. Rate, review, subscribe. 5 stars, please. Helps with the algorithms, helps get us some notoriety. Feel free to share us with your friends. Word of mouth is the best way to gain anything. And hopefully we'll catch you in a couple weeks when Zach's back. Bye. Oh, yeah. Amen and Selah. Yeah. And bye.